Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. As a reminder for those who are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. That's the best place that if you have some observations or comments you'd like to make, or if you think there's a question that needs to be asked that it doesn't look like we're asking, go ahead and fold it in there. We'll both be monitoring the chat room, and if it's good enough to break above the ambient noise, we'll pull it in to the discussion. And before we get on to the show, I just want to make a note, as I'm sure almost all of our listeners know, somebody who has was part of the Navy mill blogging community since 2003, good old Neptunus Lex. He passed last week serving his country in the manner at which he thought he could service it best in the cockpit. And I know a lot of us have had our thoughts and our prayers with both him and his family, and those who he impacted during his active duty career and in retirement. I think we will all miss good old Lex, but I think he's left a pretty solid record of accomplishment and a good legacy for everybody. So, shipmate, we'll see you on the other side, and we'll try to fill the gap as best we can. Now, back to the topic at hand. As we put out in the advertisement, the last decade has brought, I think, two aspects that, except for very short periods of conflict, had mostly been theoretical for most of your line officers. And that's the interaction of the law and how the U.S. military does its work. The term lawfare has once been used almost as an insult and a snide remark. Actually, is becoming part of an undercurrent to all that we do, an application of force overseas. But as the war that we're engaged in doesn't have bright, shining lines where we can define where the enemy is, also there's been a good and proper discussion of the role of the U.S. military internally to the United States in relates to our civilian population, also foreign nationals inside of our borders. And today we'd like to talk about what changes we've seen, what are the issues as we stand today, and what are the trend lines going forward. And I think we have an outstanding guest to address this subject today. That is, we have Major General Charles Dunlap, Jr., U.S. Air Force retired. He's a former Deputy Judge Advocate General of the Air Force and is now the Visiting Professor on the Practice of Law, Executive Director of Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at the Duke University School of Law. General Dunlap, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much, Sal. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm excited about our discussion, and I think you picked a good topic.
And it's real timely. I know we'll get on some of the late-breaking news soon, but Right. Always one of the entertaining things about to get a host is sometimes you can ask the question that is probably at least a semester or two to answer. But it's it's something when I was thinking about having you on board today, and what a great opportunity that is to address issues that really everybody from the strategic corporal to the perplexed operational commander in the field is part of his everyday thoughts. And especially in the last decade, one thing came to mind. I was reading another article, a cliche. It's not a cliche. I mean, it's a phrase from one of the great military thinkers of all time. That is very applicable to the war we're at. Sun Tzu said, "No nation ever prospers from a long war." And when I was thinking about having you on today, it also came up that great jurist once said that hard cases produce bad law. And kind of as an opening question for you, we've been at this asymmetric war for over a decade now. And the law has really tried to answer a lot of the questions that this has produced that are new for this generation of warfighters. How have you seen in the last decade the challenges that we've encountered intersecting ethics, law, and the conduct of U.S. military forces?
Well, Sal, I've always had this idea that warfare often parallels what happens in civilian society, and particularly in economics. And in the last decade, probably the last couple decades, we've seen the growth of globalization. And embedded in that is, you know, the rise of information technologies, which has had its own effect. This very broadcast would have been unheard of a decade ago. But in addition to that, we find now with global trade, we need to have global law, or law that is, will make investors feel confident as they, as they operate. And what we've seen happen in the commercial arena always spills over into the warfare arena. For example, when we had the industrialization in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that bled over and recharacterized warfare in the First World War. And then we had the internal combustion engine. But now we have global trade overlaid with global information systems. And I think that this has done a couple things. One, it's sort of normalized law around the globe. It's hard to believe, but in China, just 20 years ago, they didn't have law the way we might have thought of it in the West. Now they are part of international forums and so forth. A lot more people are thinking about international law than maybe was the case before. In addition, you mentioned the strategic corporal, and I'm sure we'll get on with it, get on to those kinds of questions in just a few minutes, given recent breaking news. But it really is true. With global information systems, what the strategic corporal does can have, game-changing impacts. So when you look at these things that have happened, it's really not surprising that in conflict we have adversaries, and we ourselves very much look to the law as yet another dimension in which this conflict will take place. I think that a lot of our adversaries see it as an opportunity to wage asymmetric warfare against us. You know, in the first Gulf War, you might remember the Alfredo's bunker incident. This is a bunker that we believed was a command and control facility. In fact, it probably was a command and control facility. What we did not know at that time was that it was being used as a bomb shelter by families of high Iraqi officials. Well, to make a long story short, we bombed it, tragically enough, the spectacle of the bodies being dragged out of that particular bunker ended up on CNN, and it had a practical political effect of not, succeeding where the Iraqi air defense did not succeed, in that it very much restricted our ability to bomb downtown Baghdad. And that was in the 1991 war. So I think our adversaries have gone to school on that, and they look for the opportunity to use law, and especially the allegations of illegality, to as kind of an asymmetric weapon to what Clausewitz might say to erode his remarkable trinity, which is, the people, the military, and the government, to try to separate the people from the military and the government, and that way prevail in a conflict. I do hasten to add, though, that we use law, and we should use law, because potentially, we'd rather have battles in courtrooms or with lawyers than with real soldiers and civilians and so forth involved in a kinetic operation. For example, early on in Operation Enduring Freedom, there were commercial entities that were selling satellite photographs of sensitive areas in the area of operation. And there are a number of things that we could have done in a traditional military way of stopping that information from getting to the bad guys. But instead we used a legal weapon, a contract in this instance, to buy up all the satellite photographs, the photography that might have otherwise been available, and in that way had the same effect as if we had done it in a more traditional military way of preventing that information from getting to the bad guy. But I think the more common use we've seen is the exploitation of either manufactured incidents or real incidents like Abu Ghraib, where it's the illegalities that have really set back the military operation. It's very tragic in its own way that the biggest defeat that the U.S. has suffered since 9/11 had nothing to do with force of arms, but rather had to do with illegalities. And I would suggest to you that that's Abu Ghraib. You know, General Petraeus says that Abu Ghraib is non-biodegradable, and even to this day, it works against us in our operations around the world. So I think that there have been any number of factors that have raised the consciousness of law in the international scene, and like everything else, it then becomes, people look to it to weaponize it, so to speak, and to use it in 21st century conflicts.
Well, in one of your original articles, I consider you the father of the term lawfare, although I guess credit may go for that actual phrase to someone else, but you seem to be given credit for the popularization.
The modern use.
The modern use. I'm not sure. Sure if that's a tag you necessarily want, but
exactly.
You did point out one of your early articles that we'd have a lot of self-inflicted wounds as far as the use of lawfare, where we will. I think one of your articles pointed out that we will suddenly declare that we have no intention of bombing innocent civilians, even though under the historic laws of war, such as they are, that may not necessarily be illegal. Can you kind of go through that process?
Sal, you're exactly right. And I think what you're referring to is a number of pronouncements that NATO has made. And I think it's a classic illustration where people try to, quote, improve, unquote, upon the law, and in doing so, it creates unintended consequences. And let me clarify the incident I think you're talking about. I believe it was in 2006, as a result of an airstrike that went awry and civilians were killed, a NATO spokesman said words to the effect that, well, if there's any civilians in the area, we're not going to bomb. And then a year later, there was another incident. Another NATO spokesman came out and said words to the effect that even if there's just one civilian down there, we're not going to bomb, even if it's Osama bin Laden. Now, there are 1,000 things wrong with what he had to say, not the least of which is that's not the law. The law allows you to use force even when you know innocent civilians are going to be killed, provided that the military objective that you're attacking is of sufficient gravity so as to justify that incidental loss of civilian life. And the reason for it is pretty simple, because if that wasn't the rule, what adversaries would do is they would surround themselves with civilians. Well, when the NATO spokesman made that pronouncement, it's not surprising that we see exactly that happening, where we have adversaries in Afghanistan in particular who embed themselves with civilians, surround themselves with civilians to try to create some kind of sanctuary that the law doesn't require, but to which NATO seemed to have committed themselves. Now, I think that today the rules of engagement and so forth have been revised back to where, you know, it's more in compliance or more adhering to what the traditional interpretation of the law is. But nevertheless, when you make those kinds of pronouncements, you telegraph to an adversary an opportunity to exploit innocent civilians in a way that is going to create for him a sanctuary that is more effective than if he had a huge air defense system. So I think it's a way, well-intentioned perhaps, but it's an illustration of the dangers when people try to monkey around with what the law requires and doesn't require and add new requirements that are seem to be more effective than the law, but at the end of the day, they are they have the opposite effect too often.
If I could pull the thread on that a little bit, I think what you also see, especially with NATO, is it's very much based on the lowest common denominator, and this is what I mean. If you have your, up to 28 nations now, that many times a spokesman for political reasons will pick the definition of the most restrictive, and you often see that in NATO operations where they can only do up to the point that somebody will veto. And so you may have six nations, and of which one of them may actually have in their law things written a certain way. So the organization will feel that everybody should obey that. And it folds into something, you know, we've seen, let's stick with Europe while we're at it. We've seen more than one case of the freewheeling Spanish judge putting out arrest warrants for a variety of people for performing military duties. We have the precedents being set by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We also have the case in 2000 of the arrest and seizure of Augusto Pinochet. And we even have some members of the U.S. Supreme Court that have talked about the importance of the law in other nations impacting their decisions on cases here in the U.S. affecting U.S. citizens. There have been efforts to go after Kissinger, Rumsfeld, chatter, but nothing really done about individuals in the U.S. military. Where are the trends in that, and what are the dangers to U.S. military personnel that may face legally in the future that past generations really haven't had to worry about?
Well, actually, you touched on a couple of really important and interesting issues. Let me tackle the first one, coalition operations. What you mentioned is very true. When you're in a coalition operation like NATO, you're concerned not just about international law. International law is sometimes the easy part. The hard part is often meshing the many different domestic laws of each of the players. For example, I've been on operations where country A may require certain kinds of evidence before or certain kinds of data or information before they'll permit their forces to engage an adversary. These are things not required by international law, but are required by their domestic law or policies that their government wishes their forces to carry out. And so when you're in a coalition operation, you're always trying to get the same rules of engagement to be applied to everyone. But that rarely is the case. There are often exceptions that are carved out by particular nations as to what they will or will not do. And that creates complications for the coalition force commander. Sometimes it does bleed over into international law. For example, the United States is not a party to Protocol 1 of the Geneva Conventions, which has a lot of the targeting kind of information or targeting kind of rules that we often talk about. The U.S. considers much of that to be customary international law, and we do follow it, but we are not a party to the protocol. Another one is we're not a party to the Ottawa Convention, which is the NIA Personnel Landmine Convention, because we believe that there are ways that landmines can be used in a way that is consistent, certainly consistent with the law of war, but in certain instances it may even make war less vicious, as odd as that may sound, and we can get into that if you'd like. You also raise a separate issue, and that's the growth of universal jurisdiction. This, to oversimplify it, universal jurisdiction means that a particular country will determine that for certain kinds of crimes, it has jurisdiction even though the crime may not involve any of its own citizens. It may not have incurred on its sovereign territory or whatever. If it's a certain kind of crime that they view as needing to be punished somewhere, they'll have universal jurisdiction. In other words, it's the kind of jurisdiction that doesn't necessarily have the normal kinds of things that you look for, like it happened in this country or something like that. And the International Criminal Court, which is what we call the Rome Statute, that's what we call the treaty. The U.S. isn't a party to it, nor is, I think, Russia and China and a number of other, Israel, I don't think is a party to the Rome Treaty. It purports to extend jurisdiction over people who didn't sign up for it. And that has generated a lot of concern in this country. In fact, we have a law that requires when we, say, have an exercise in another country who is a party, that they agree that jurisdiction will revert to the U.S. for any offenses that occur. This is a very problematic development for a number of reasons. And I think the one that you hear most often is the fear that it's going to be used for political purposes against the U.S. And certainly that is a concern. As you look at the way the statute is built and the way the treaty is built, I will concede that it is very unlikely that it could be used in that way. There are a number of things built into it that would mitigate against that kind of thing happening, but you can't say it's impossible. And it's unlikely that an individual U.S. soldier would be held accountable to the International Criminal Court for a whole variety of reasons. But again, you can't say it's impossible. And one of the aspects of this that I don't hear discussed very often, but is something that concerns me, and that is the whole notion that we have an all-volunteer force. And when the nation sends people in harm's way to do the nation's business, and let's assume that they are alleged to have done something wrong, I think that they are entitled to be tried by a U.S. court, be it a court-martial or federal court or whatever. And the circumstances of an international tribunal, the whole idea that we would be turning over someone to an international tribunal, I think does not strike Americans well. And I think that will ultimately be a very difficult aspect of the process should we ever, you know, seriously be moving towards becoming a member of the International Criminal Court, as I think the process is moving that way. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a real political fight.
Well, I was going to go off on a question originally about piracy and terrorism and universal jurisdiction, but since you've raised the issue of trial of an American soldier, sailor, marine who's done something wrong in the context of being at war, we've got this situation now in Afghanistan, as I'm sure you know, where a U.S. soldier is accused of killing, I think, 16 civilians. He's turned himself into a U.S. authorities. Where do you see that going? Where are we going to take him home? Are we just going to hang on to him until we finally leave Afghanistan? And other than the fact that it creates a disaster for us in Afghanistan, along the lines of Abu Ghraib in Iraq, where do we go forward with this thing?
Well, I imagine that right now it's in the midst of the professional criminal investigators like NCIS or OSI or, CID. I'm sure that they are right now in the midst of that criminal investigation, that gathering facts. It's difficult to see where this will go, not knowing any more than what we know now. But clearly, it has the potential to be a game changer. This is the epitome of the strategic corporal, not knowing, of course, the rank of the person suspected. One would hope that that this is the act of a mentally deranged person, but we know from the Hassan case that sometimes these things can be more complicated than that. I think we really will have to see what the investigation produces and get some more facts, but it's hard to conceive of a more serious threat to the entire Afghanistan mission than the allegations that we've seen in the news today. It really has the potential to be a game changer. And again, it's ironic if it is, because, again, we're not talking about the traditional battlefield defeat. This isn't Dien Bien Phu. This is an entirely different kind of setback, equally potentially grievous, but simply on the basis of an illegality and a lack of discipline. And it really is a very tragic kind of incident. But I want to emphasize, we have got to get the facts first and make sure we understand what those facts are before we start speculating about what the disposition ought to be.
Yeah, when it's pretty much a wait and see. I think I put a post out earlier today, said this is going to get ugly. Just what degree of ugly it's going to get, and I think in many cases, I think what you said is exactly what everybody needs to do, is nod their head that it's taking place, but let's wait and find out more details and hope that we got the right people in the right place to try to mitigate whatever blowback comes back. But, and I thought there's an article, and I would encourage everybody to, all you have to do is, you know, Google Charles J. Dunlop Jr. and Lawfare today, ... and tomorrow. I think you picked a really good quote to start off that. You had it from former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, quote, "A principal strategic tactic of the Taliban is either provoking or exploiting civilian casualties," unquote. You talk about a significant unforced strategic error. That's pretty much meets that definition.
Right. And one of the things I found interesting is the statement that Secretary Panetta put out today about this incident, where he said the person was acting clearly outside the chain of command. I thought that was a little bit curious, because you know, one would certainly hope that's the case, but how do we know who may or may not have been involved, you know, down to the squad leader or whatever? I don't think it's a good idea to start speculating on who may or may not have been responsible. So I thought that was a little bit curious to see that in his statement, that he felt the need to exonerate the chain of command before the investigation had been done. And as we know from the Hassan investigation, there were things in the chain of command that should have been addressed and could have been addressed. So that's why I think that what we've been talking about, let's get the facts before we start, you know, too much speculation. But I think what we can say and what we do know is that this is going to have a very adverse effect on our relations with the Afghans and on our mission in Afghanistan. And it comes down to old-fashioned, you know, discipline, and it's just a tragedy of stupendous dimensions.
And it's in many ways ironic, because in my career, I'll just use two data points as an example. I don't think there has been a time in history where a military has been so focused on avoiding civilian casualties. I remember back in Desert Fox in the late 90s, we were lobbing TLAMs and everything else like there is no tomorrow. The JAG was off to the side. not really involved in my conscious memory at all, even at the staff level. But then I fast forwarded to my last operational tour. I just beat you by a year there, General Dunlap. I retired in 09. in 08 and 09, watching how, make sure I put this correctly, how intimately involved the, quote, battle JAG was, unquote, in targeting and executing missions and such, specifically to try to mitigate the odds of civilian casualties. And quite a few people have talked about this, and I just wanted to get your take on it, is with how close the battle JAG is, as we called her, intimately involved in these decisions, how has that impacted the commander's flexibility, the commander's responsibility and accountability, and has it brought the JAGs into an arena that is maybe a little too deep for them, or is this something that has, over the last few years, evolved and grown to the point that it is an expected part of the career?
Well, I almost burst into laughter because I was the JAG for Desert Fox.
whatever y'all were doing, it was hidden from us at the Pointy End.
Yeah, I think you make a good point because, you know, the differences from Desert Fox to today are pretty dramatic because at Desert Fox, we had, there were two JAGs, myself and one other guy in the command center in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, when you know, two people can only do so much and the process was different. We did review the targets and so forth. But today, you have in an air operations center, you have JAGs there around the clock, and it's not just in the battle cab. They're embedded in the planning process and with the targeteers and the weaponeers and so forth. And so you have a much more sophisticated approach. All of that said, it's still the commander's war. You know, the JAG makes recommendations. The JAG has certain responsibilities if there was, you know, an explicit violation of the law of war or a suspected violation of the law of war. But that typically isn't the case. Mostly what you end up doing on these operations really has to do with the rules of engagement, which ordinarily are very complicated, but not because of the law of war, but because of the policies that have been overlaid over the law of war. But you also make another good point. To be qualified as a lawyer, as a judge advocate, to advise a commander, knowing the law is only part of it. That is only step one. That you're assumed to know. But to be competent, you have to know, quote, the client's business in a very special way. In other words, you have to know a lot about weapons, about the platforms, about strategies, and so forth, because it's not helpful to the commander for a lawyer to sit there and just say, well, that's illegal. What you have to do is work through in an intelligent and knowledgeable way how the commander can accomplish what he wants to do within the law. And normally, very often, there's a way of doing that, but you have to be pretty knowledgeable to be able to help offer alternatives that will achieve the same end that the commander wants. And the commanders now are pretty savvy to this, and they're pretty selective about who they want as their judge advocate, and they want someone who really knows their business, and they'll test them in their own way. And if they don't meet their requirements, they'll get a new one, quite frankly. But having said all this, we have to remember that, you know, warfare is an art. There are things that only reside in the mind of the commander. And so the judge advocate is yet one of the advisors. I rarely, I can't think of a single incident in my career where a commander explicitly wanted to do something that he knew violated the law of war. I never really saw that. Most of the time, the questions were in the gray area, like, geez, the proportionality analysis. Will the casualties be, quote, clearly excessive? That's the rule in the law, vis-a-vis the military advantage sought. Well, the law doesn't provide much more of an explanation than that, so it comes down to subjective factual determination, which the commander is often the one in the best position to make that particular judgment, because the commander knows the value of that military objective being sought. So the judge advocate, I don't want us to get to the point where we have lawyers, you know, picking the targets and calling the shots. They're not qualified to do that. Even the best, even the ones who have made the study of the art of war, you know, part of their professional development. It has to be a commander's decision. And one of the things that I saw that a little bit disturbed me, this was about a year and a half or so ago, it was in the Wall Street Journal. There was an article where, for whatever reason, there was a JAG who was at some little FOB, a forward operating base in Afghanistan. And, you know, there was a mortar attack or something. And the commander runs down to the JAG and basically says, hey, can we shoot back? Well, that is the wrong way. That's going way overboard. We need to inculcate into commanders and troops, you know, the basics of the law of war. And, of course, we'll take action when we see the obvious violations. But we can't expect to fight a war with a JAG, you know, in every cockpit or every, you know, armored vehicle or looking over the shoulder of every rifleman. That's not the way to conduct a war. I think that there can be the temptation sometimes to do that, but it certainly is not. It's not a realistic or an effective, ultimately, way of conducting operations.
Well, I smile a little bit as a former in-house corporate lawyer whose task it was to help my business clients achieve objectives, even if the way they originally wanted to do it might be illegal, but to help them find a way to do it legally. In your description of what the JAGs do, it's just, you know, it is the same concept. It's just the business is slightly different, obviously. I have a question that kind of relates to the last thing you were talking about, which is, I want to see if I can express this correctly. Are some commanders more prone to shirk their command obligations by looking to the lawyers? And, you know, and then if they get a thumb down on some operation, just saying, well, it's the lawyers won't let us do that, or is that, especially at the level you're talking about, the FOB in a base, is that something that you have seen or might?
I think that is a phenomenon that you do see in some commanders. I think there are some commanders who don't, for one reason or another, don't want to do something, or they don't want to make that hard decision. And so they're quite happy to abdicate to a lawyer that kind of decision. And it's wrong. You see it often in discipline cases. You know, they don't like being the bad guy. So they like saying, well, the JAG says we have to do this. No, the JAG doesn't say you have to do that. The JAG recommends it. The commander makes that decision and has to live with it one way or the other. But I think, I often tell people, I spent as much time in my career telling commanders, especially in operational matters, no, that's not illegal. No, you can do that. It might not be smart, but no, the law doesn't prohibit you from doing X or Y, as I did telling them just the opposite. So I think part of that is an extreme sensitivity on the part of some commanders, a fear of being wrong. But another part of it is not wanting to make those hard decisions. I can't tell you it's a common thing, fortunately, but it does happen. And I think it reflects a fear on the part of some commanders of simply being wrong. And strangely enough, I think it's in Wesley Clark's book where he talks a little bit about that. And this is his book, Waging Modern War, which I know there's a lot of people who aren't fans of Wesley Clark, but this book is pretty instructive about modern conflicts, and admittedly it's about Kosovo. But those who are interested in this subject, I recommend it to them because it's insightful. I don't always agree, but he has some interesting observations about the interplay between law, policy, lawyers, politicians in modern, highly politicized conflicts.
I think you brought up the key word there, at least what I've seen. I mean, that fear, the fear of being wrong. I think that fear derives in a large part the fear that in human institutions, you know, things happen. We're not perfect by design. That they're going to be thrown under the bus, a lack. And again, it goes back to a fundamental of leadership and a lack of faith in their leadership that will throw them under the bus for their own preservation, whether they've done something wrong or not. So if they have somebody else to have a substitute throw under the bus, like, don't throw me under the bus, throw the JAG under the bus, I think a lot of that derives from fear. And on that, I wanted to you know, part of your modern CV has the E word in it, ethics. And I wanted to bounce off something for you. Is loyalty, that word, whether it's in a fit rep or a award citation or a description of somebody, it's used a lot in the military. But when I hear it used, it usually refers to personal loyalty of a junior to a senior. And the question I have from an ethical point of view, and sometimes how we see people get into trouble, is in the more important loyalty that towards the institution or the service that you're part of in the nation it serves, not so much the loyalty to the individual. And if so, what is some good guidance out there for young officers to look at, or even some senior officers that need a refresher, on the ethical idea of loyalty? So when somebody finds themselves in an ethical quandary between a personal loyalty and what should be a higher loyalty, that they could use as a reference to see whether they're really going in the right direction.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think it's pretty clear, well, it should be clear, that the loyalty should be ultimately to the institution and to the country. You take an oath in this country to support and defend the Constitution, not as the Germans prior to World War II took an oath to Hitler personally. So in this country, our loyalty needs to start with the Constitution and with the institution. You do see, however, loyalty to individuals and to units almost overstep the loyalty to the larger values. I've seen, and we've all seen it, those of us that served, where a unit will be more concerned about protecting somebody in their unit than doing the right thing, to the point where they don't report misconduct or whatever it may be. I think for young officers, the development of their ethical meter is one of the most important things and one of the things I'm most concerned about, because it's very easy for a young officer to get the wrong set of values. Because personal loyalty does have its place, and it is an important value. It just can't be used to trump the loyalty to the institution and ultimately to the Constitution. And personal loyalty, I think, starts getting confused when it manifests itself in not telling someone what they need to hear. One of the things that I think commanders these days value the most out of their JAGs is lawyers are kind of in the business of telling people what they want to hear, what they need to hear versus what they want to hear. And that's one reason why they're so unpopular. But commanders tend to value that. And they, I think young officers need to understand that true loyalty means telling the commander what he or she needs to hear versus what they want to hear. And true loyalty is doing the right thing when it may not be consistent with a career, ultimately. In other words, I can't sit here and tell folks that if you do the right thing, if you do the ethical thing, that you're going to be vindicated and it's all going to come out right, because it doesn't always work out that way. It doesn't mean that you don't do the right thing, but you need to understand that there's a certain kind of moral courage that's involved and that there's a risk involved, and you have to be willing to pay the price if you want to be an ethical, moral person. And so I think that most commanders understand this. Most officers understand this, but they don't always make it as clear to the junior officer as they should. And I think that they sometimes underestimate and allow the junior officer to confuse the notion of being a can-do young lieutenant and a young lieutenant who can-does the wrong thing, thinking that that's what, you know, the boss wanted. And so in developing these ethical parameters, I think the only way of doing it is with some honest small group discussion among officers where different scenarios are put out by the commander. The commander has got to set the tone. One of the things I used to tell wing commanders at the wing commanders course, which for those of your listeners who don't know, that's I'm trying to think of an equivalent, but it's sort of like a brigade commander, or it's a very senior 06 position. What I used to tell them is how easily they can be misinterpreted. So one of the things that they need to tell the staffs from day one is, if you ever think you hear me tell you to do something illegal or immoral, I want you to know that's not what I intend, and we need to have a conversation. You need to bring that up to me so that we can get things straightened out, because I never intend you to do something illegal or immoral. See, if they say that affirmatively, then that empowers the junior officer to do the right thing when he or she may think that something is wrong. Now, very often they don't have the full picture, or they don't understand really what the request was, but it can be very corruptive to an organization when the young officers start thinking that, well, I guess that's just the way it's done. You know, there really aren't, the rules really don't matter if this is what the boss wants. And I think it's an iterative process, but it's a very important one, and one that perhaps we don't spend enough time training our young folks to understand and do things the right way.
This is going to be an odd segue from that. I think your points are well made. Recently, Attorney General Holder has, I guess you would say, justified or at least commented on the use of drones, predator drone, to attack an American citizen, attack and kill an American citizen who was alleged to be a terrorist. I know that last year's LENS program at Duke was pretty much on that topic. Could you kind of discuss that, the law as you perceive it on that kind of activity?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because just today in the New York Times, there's an editorial just lambasting Holder for that position, and particularly because he was saying that judicial review wasn't required. Well, basically, what the law is it does, if you are an adversary, it doesn't matter that you happen to be a U.S. citizen. Tragically enough, we have had instances in our past where we have had U.S. citizens who have been fighting for the other side. I actually agree with much of what Attorney General Holder said. I do not want judges determining who should or should not be a target, whether they're U.S. citizens, foreign persons, or whoever, if they are part of the adversary's the entity which is the adversary. Now, recently in the international scene, the International Committee of the Red Cross and other international law experts have grappled with this issue of what really is, when the other side, so to speak, is not wearing uniforms, who really is part of that group that is subject to attack outside of a law enforcement scenario? Well, they've come down with the definition that is essentially, if it's an organized armed group that's directly participating in hostilities, then a person who is part of that organized armed group is subject to attack, just like a soldier in a uniformed soldier in an army. For example, under international law, if you're part of the military of a belligerent in an armed conflict, you can be killed in your bed at night, even though you're unarmed and not presenting a threat to anybody, per se, because just by the status of being a member of the armed forces. So now that we're fighting adversaries who choose not to wear uniforms or be part of an armed force, we should not give them more entitlements for not complying with the law of war, which requires the wear of uniforms and carrying arms openly and being organized and so forth. We should not give them more rights for defying the law of war than what we give to people who comply with the law of war. So conceptually, what Attorney General Holder has said is very true and very accurate. But I don't think, this is where I fault the administration, I don't think that they have talked through the rationale adequately, because Americans out there are thinking, well, wait a second, does this mean like a predator can land in my living room or something like this, a missile from predator, something like that, which of course is not the case. But I think a leadership needs to work through the explanation and the rationale in a lot more detail than has been done to date. I think it's helpful to read Judge Bates's opinion in the Al-Awlaki case. Remember, Al-Awlaki was the guy in Yemen, the American citizen in Yemen, who was killed in the predator strike, and what his rationale was. But that needs to be translated from a judge's opinion into something that is more accessible for the general public. That's what leadership's about. I think Attorney General Holder made a good speech, but it's not a great speech because it leaves too many questions unanswered and the rationale as yet not clear enough, I think, for the American for the typical American to accept it. I don't know. I haven't seen the polls, but I think the most recent polls indicate that most Americans do support the drone attacks. But I don't know if it was in the specific context of a drone attack against an American citizen.
Yeah, I think I always reference our founding years of our republic when it comes to the views of the utility and proper place of a military in a representative republic. I think we're in a little bit of a soft territory in some respects, though not unprecedented in our country's history. And a couple of years ago, I saw General Cartwright give a speech where we were talking about cybersecurity and cyber war. And I walked away rather disturbed by the not only what he had to say, but the question and answer afterwards. Is he seemed to have a very cavalier attitude towards the role of the U.S. military tackling what in many respects is a law enforcement operation in potentially inside the lifelines of our country. And I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know, traditionally people think of national assets as, you know, ports, fuel, lines of communications, but in the second decade of the 21st century, information and digital assets are just as important to a country's economic viability. But where do you see the trends on our senior leadership's military-wise view of the proper role of the U.S. military in cybersecurity in both offense and defense?
Well, I'm very concerned, particularly about the defense, because the defense requires a lot of involvement with domestic ISPs and so forth. I am not a fan, if you've read my work, The Origins of the Military Coup of 2012, which, by the way, was written in 1992.
I meant to mention that. It flows into the undercurrent there very well, I think.
It does. I think there are few examples in the history of the world where the armed forces has been used for domestic security, however defined, where that has turned out to be a good thing for democracy. I think the same is true here. I am not suggesting at all that we should not have robust cyber defenses, and the military has to have its own defenses. But I think that we would be much better if we built a civilian agency to be responsible for cyber defense, even of critical infrastructure in this country. Cyber offense, maybe that's better in military hands when you're talking about doing things in the context of a conflict. Talking about doing things overseas. But domestically, because of the things you need to do to have a good cyber defense, which does involve U.S. citizens and civilians and so forth, I am much, much more in favor of robusting up a civilian capability in Homeland Security or wherever, which is very much of the law enforcement mode, and very much of the idea of assuming at the first instance it's a criminal act and proceeding that way. There's lots of things that we can do in a passive way to have robust defenses, and then when we have to do the investigation, there's things that we can do better on the law enforcement side. And when we look at externally at threats from overseas, that's perhaps where the military can get involved. But I think that we need to have some pretty clear lines here. And I think that there's a place. Everybody likes to talk about tearing down the walls and intelligence and so forth. But there's a place for walls. And there's reasons for walls, because the way the military thinks about things is appropriate for an armed conflict, but it's not necessarily appropriate for the way we want security forces, however defined, to interface with American citizens here at home. So I think it's all these assumptions that it's no big deal, I think is very short-sighted. And I think that the affection that the American people have for the armed forces, which the armed forces need in an all-volunteer force, is put at risk in any time and in any way the U.S. military is used for a domestic security purpose, to include cybersecurity. So I'm probably alone in this view, but I think I think you have identified something that we need to have more of a national discussion about.
Well, General, you've been very kind to spend some time with Sal and me this afternoon, and I think we could both ask another 2 weeks worth of questions and have you discuss this, because you've been a great guest. What have you got on your plate coming up that we can look forward to in the near future, and where should people look for what you're up to?
Well, thanks for bringing it up. We have a conference down here at Duke Law School. It's free. It's April 13th and 14th. Your listeners can get more information by calling area code 919-613-7206. Our subject of the conference is After Afghanistan, Where To From Here. We're going to look at all different kinds of legal dimensions, many of the things that we've discussed this afternoon. You can also go to our website at Duke Law School. If you look under the Center for Law, Ethics, and National Security, once you get to the law school site and look under conferences, you'll get all the information. It is a free conference, but you must register in advance. And I can tell you, the seats are going quickly. So I hope to see all your listeners there.
Well, you'll see me there. I've already signed up for it. So.
And,
fantastic.
I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you, but I'll go there and check to see where they're going to I don't know whether they're going to have that available online. You can watch either archived later or not, because that sounds like a very pertinent, very interesting topic. I wouldn't be able to be there physically, but, boy, I'd like to get my handle on it one way or another. And I would like to join Eagle One as well as thanking you very much for taking an hour this Sunday to come visit with us. Very quick hour, very informative, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was great to have this discussion with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, General.
Thank you, General. And I'd like to thank everybody who joined us live and even those coming with the archive. Hope y'all have a great Navy Day.
Drove me silly, hoping you're the same.